JAXA Space and Astronautical Science Podcast.
Welcome to the JAXA Space and Astronautical Science Podcast. I'm your host, Toshihisa Mikaido. Today's guest is actually the first guest we have from a branch of JAXA other than the ISIS Sagamihara campus. Today, our guest is Dr. Andrea Sanska, working at the Chofu Aerospace Center of JAXA. In this episode, we discuss aircraft manufacturing limitations and future prospects, the use of augmented reality and digital twins in both aircraft manufacturing and society, utilizing artificial intelligence and machine learning in aircraft design, the process of writing research papers as an engineer, the food culture in Japan and the importance of NATO, making music around the world, wind tunnels and fluid dynamics, and much more. Please enjoy. Today's guest is Dr. Andrea Sanska from the Chofu Aerospace Center of JAXA. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. My pleasure.
So I like to start the episode just by asking the guests, what is it that you do at JAXA?
So currently, I am a research scientist in the Aviation Technology Directorate, and I'm part of the Digital Integrated Design Technology Team. Our department is called the Aircraft Lifecycle Innovation Hub.
So is that actually designing new aircrafts for flights on Earth?
Yes. Mostly we're talking about airplanes with specific interest about commercial aircrafts. So differently from previous podcasts, this is a bit less space related.
That's perfectly fine. You're actually, I think, our first guest who is not from the ISIS Sagamihara campus on the show.
Oh, I see.
So it's going to be interesting. So I guess one of the first questions that comes to mind about that is, as you mentioned, JAXA is relatively, or probably more generally known as a space exploration agency. But you said that this is designing aircraft for commercial flights. Is this in collaboration with any of the commercial airlines in Japan? Or what is the goal of JAXA for the design of new aircrafts?
Yes, indeed. We have many projects that are in collaboration with the big Japanese aircraft manufacturers, going from, for example, MHI, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. Yeah, one of the big objectives that we have is always trying to develop tools and technologies that we can export and give to industry so that they can use it effectively to develop new aircrafts.
Is this a mutually beneficial relationship? This might be more on the political side of the question, so I'm not sure if you have any information, but is this? I can see how this is definitely helpful for the industry that actually developed the aircraft and the commercial airlines themselves. But what does JAXA get out of this? Do you know?
So of course there's a lot of exchange in terms of knowledge, but also funding. So some of the projects, at least in the past, they were funded also through collaborations with external companies. But I think now it tends more to be from the government, everything coming from the government. So it is obviously interest of the government to support Japanese industry also through the work of JAXA.
That makes sense. I want to dig a little bit deeper into what you actually do, what problems you are currently working on, and how your day is organized at JAXA. Could you go a little bit into that and explain that, please?
Yeah, sure. So the big project I'm part of is this aircraft digital transformation. The idea is that currently developing an airplane is very complex, time-consuming, and very expensive, at the point that we are almost incapable of introducing new technologies. And one of the big problems is the certification. So making sure
whatever new technology or airplane in general that we develop is safe to fly. With certification, we're having a lot of problems. So one of the big trends now all over the world for many, many applications and also for aircraft is to digitalize our product. And what we want to do is for each phase of the aircraft life cycle, and these phases normally are design, manufacturing, certification, then operational life and disposal. What we want to do is for each phase, creating a digital version of the aircraft on which we can actually perform digital operations instead of doing it on the physical plane. And by doing this, we can significantly reduce time, costs, without compromising on the aircraft overall safety. However, to produce this digital versions for each phase of the aircraft life, we need very powerful and accurate simulation tools, numerical tools in general. And this is the challenge, because we want these tools that are accurate but are very rapid at the same time. Some of the operations that we want to do with these tools are real-time operations. Biggest challenge is to create what we call digital twin, that is a one-to-one version of the physical aircraft, but fully digital. And we would like to be able to predict real time what happens on this digital twin. And for doing so, me in the specific, in my team, we are developing some methods that are based on, for example, fluid dynamic technologies or structural analysis and artificial intelligence to create this at the same time accurate but computationally cheap tools to support these different phases of the aircraft.
You're essentially creating the physics-based world for the aircraft and then running it through different stages of the life cycle within this simulation?
Yeah, so for each phase, we imagine to have different virtual counterparts. So for example, in the design phase, we imagine to have many different configuration of aircraft. And during this design phase, we start testing all these virtual counterparts for different flight conditions, for example, either the normal ones like cruise, but also the more extreme ones and off design. And once we perform these tests, we start selecting the best ones, and these best ones then move to a new phase. So we try to do what we do in real life with an aircraft. The design phase is a bit special because we often, also in the past, we used to do many tests, physical tests in the wind tunnels, but also using simulations. So the design phase changes a little bit, but conceptually is still very similar. We imagine to have an aircraft and we do tests on it. But the game changer for this digital transformation is that for the other phases, starting from manufacturing and certification, where normally in real life we would have an actual plane to do tests on. Now we want to create these digital twins, or for example, in the manufacturing and certification phase, they would be called digital prototype. And on that, we do whatever tests we normally do in real life. So, and normally, these tests that we do in real life, for example, are done either to verify some of the assumptions that we made during the design phase, or to simply certify the aircraft for safety and all requirements are satisfied. And now trying to do this certification with some simulations is also quite important, because at this point, if we can prove that doing tests digitally is equivalent to doing tests in real life, then we can avoid to do tests in real life, do them only digitally, and save a lot of money and a lot of time.
So when you previously mentioned that people have become almost incapable of introducing new technologies in this field, is this mostly due to regulations and costs, or are there other factors as well?
So indeed, there's a big discussion also going on about the actual certification requirements. So there's a certain aspect that is a bit more politics, where the regulations indeed are not done for making it easy to introduce new technologies. For example, carbon fiber structures, but also a bit more advanced sensors to measure whatever aspect of your flight condition is. They become so restrictive that sometimes a drastic change in the way we would like to design a plane is a bit tough. And integrate, so often what it's preferred is incremental innovation. So small changes to an existing plane. And in this way, the new technology can be introduced, but it's not going to create, you know, a paradigm shift in terms of the macro features like, fuel consumption and overall performance in general. So the alternative that people try to make work at the moment is through this virtual versions of the airplane. The system is becoming more and more complex. These incremental innovations that have been introduced now made the airplane a very, very complex system. But if we are very good at creating the virtual version of it, we can work on that in a much more efficient way and making all certification tests, try even new generation aircrafts that are completely different. We are used to have the fuselage and wings. This is our main image of an aircraft. But there are some new configurations, or at least concepts, where the body and the wing are one thing. And the regulations that we have now don't even take into account of the possibility to test this new, completely new generation aircrafts. And this is slowing down progress in general.
In the simulations, can you simulate regulations different from the current one, or added on to the current ones as well?
Yeah, so the regulations is also something that is quite tricky, because of course they have been written for physical tests. So a lot of work that it has to be done also involves coordination with the certification bodies, like in Japan it's called JCAB, but in the US we have the FAA, or in Europe EASA, and they are those who decide certification requirements are, so that we can make sure that the plane is safe to fly. A lot of work it's being done with this certification bodies in order to create guidelines on how to certify a plane digitally. So they want to understand, and we also want to understand, how accurate these simulation tools that we are creating are. By understanding how accurate they are, we are trying to identify which bits and pieces of this, for example, certification process we can do with simulations rather than with physical tests. So that is a lot of, this is definitely outside of my area of expertise, and this is goes into almost legal, you know, realm. But definitely, that is a very important part. And without this, regulations on virtual simulations, virtual certification, we wouldn't be able to apply any of our tools. So this is a very important part.
In regards to, I guess, the digital twin as well as the simulation as a whole, the objective, as you mentioned before, is pretty much to make this as close to reality as possible so you can reduce or, I suppose, in some cases, even eliminate the actual necessity for physical test models in the future. But how close are these digital models to reality right now? Do we have a sort of a benchmark of how much progress has been made, or is that still hard to determine?
So it depends on the industry. So industry sector, the car industry support that simulation provide is pretty good. And we have seen in the last few decades the development costs and time to market for cars decreasing. The aircraft is much more complicated. We see actually in the last decades the time to market and costs increasing like constantly. And one of the big issues with the aircraft is that in the case of a car, it's relatively cheap to build a real one and verify all your simulation tools on the real product. And often what they do in the car industry is we produce many with many different configurations or whatever idea they had during the design phase. They test it and they implement what results they obtain from the physical test into their numerical tools to improve them. Obviously, doing this with an airplane is unfeasible. It would be crazily expensive. So to give you an idea of the time scale, some work that we are doing also with NASA, they are recently, there's like a workshop or that it's led by NASA, and we are part of it. And they are trying to write a roadmap for what our tools are supposed to be doing in the next years. And what we've seen so far is that many of our tools meaning industry and research tools, are limited to certain phases. They can be reliable only during certain phases of the aircraft life cycle. In the specific for certification, the roadmap indicates the ability to do some of the important maneuvers during flight testing that are required for certification in 2050. So it's a 2050. Long term.
Okay. So, yeah, still a few years off. And just in case you're listening to this episode in the future, we're in 2022 right now. So. I'm kind of interested is how this actually appears, how these simulations would appear on screen, because I think maybe it's because of my background, but in my mind, I sort of picture when you're doing a flight test that you'll have a screen similar to Ace Combat or something like a video game on on screen. But I would also assume that this is not necessarily the case as you're probably not looking for as much an entertainment as you would be just for numerical data, I suppose. Can you describe what you would see on the screen in like a flight test, for example?
So what you actually said, it's not too far from reality. For example, We already do a lot of flight simulations, and we have a JAXA flight simulator that it really looks like an aircraft cockpit. And in your screens in front of you, they really do simulate what a pilot would see, and it really looks like a flight simulator from a game. Many of these tools that we are developing are, of course, imagining that we have a full aircraft. And what the test pilot will do in the virtual cockpit in the flight simulator will effectively be what he does when he's doing a real flight test. So all the tools that we create, one of the big objectives is to do the so-called flight simulations so that we can accurately reproduce what a pilot would try to test, what a pilot feels during these flight tests. And that is one thing that it's pretty, not too far from what a video game would look like. But many other applications, they are also based on virtual reality, augmented or mixed reality. For example, we have many wind tunnels at JAXA where we do several types of experiments. In these wind tunnels, normally what happens is that we put scaled down version of an aircraft and we throw air at it. And we try to look at what happens by measuring different things. One thing that I'm also trying to do is to visualize my simulation results in real time on the scaled down model inside the wind tunnel by using also virtual reality. So actually we have bought HoloLens, and with this we can dock our virtual model to the real one in the wind tunnel while the wind tunnel is working, and my experimentalist colleague, they do the measurements. I can also look at my simulations and try to see what is going on and try to help the experimentalists to understand what problems we have, what areas of the aircraft they should look at. Because experiments often, the measurements are limited to certain parts of the model. But with the simulations, we can have access to locations that normally experimentalists cannot access. So in this way, using mixed reality, augmented reality, we can somewhat get also an idea of what the flow looks like around an aircraft and better interpret the phenomena and help, you know, experimentalists also in their studies.
That's interesting. So essentially you use the physical model and the digital data together to get a more accurate picture of how to put it together in the end. So exactly. At least until 2050, that's maybe how things will be done.
Yeah.
So earlier you mentioned you use several things such as fluid dynamics and artificial intelligence to assist with these digital models. Can you explain how artificial intelligence is implemented or used in these digital models?
Yeah, sure. So the idea is that during simulations or experiments that are accurate enough to be reliable, they normally the cost that comes with it is very high. Experiments themselves, they are very expensive. They just manufacturing a model costs a lot of money, and running the wind tunnels also is big cost. From the simulation side, instead, accurate simulations mean normally running simulations on supercomputers. We have a JAXA supercomputer called JSS3 that is a kind of a little brother of Fugaku, that is actually the most powerful supercomputer in the world, and that also he's Japanese supercomputer. running simulations on these supercomputers, if we want them to be accurate, it's very expensive. What we would like to do is using artificial intelligence, or more precisely, machine learning and deep learning, to create some simple models, some simple and cheap, quick models that can accurately predict the fluid, for example, around an aircraft or around the wing at certain conditions. And the way we build these models normally is we take existing data that we have from, for example, simulation and experiments, and we apply machine learning algorithms to create simple model that can do predictions on cases that normally we haven't used for creating the model itself. So this training database, we call it training data set, this pool of results from simulations and experiments that we use to create the model, it's normally something that we know, but there are bits and pieces, flight conditions that we don't know about. And these unknown regions of flight conditions, we would like to predict them with the AI-based model.
The AI looks at all the data that you've gathered and maybe historical data as well, and then compares that to the training data and determines any number of potential factors that could exist.
Yes. So indeed, creating these models, they rely quite strongly on the training database. So if you have a very large one, the predictive capabilities of these AI models, it will be very good. If your training data set is small, the AI model will struggle to predict cases that were not contained in this training data set. But that is, yes, a lot of work is going on about this, because what we actually have in reality is small training data sets, because as I said before, these are creating these data sets is very expensive. So there are many different directions that people are going towards. And one that I particularly like is so-called physics-informed machine learning, where we take the data that we have in this training data set, but we complement them with the physical knowledge that we have, for example, about fluids or structures or anything else. Using this physics-informed machine learning, we can start accepting this training data sets that are a bit smaller without compromising too much the predictive capabilities of our models.
Before we move on here, I would like to ask a little bit more about the digital twin that you brought up earlier. I think this is something that people might be hearing a little bit more of recently in recent days. This idea of digital twin, which I guess is a simulated copy of something in the physical world. But what are some potential uses of digital twins, and how is it currently being used as a technology in the world today?
Yeah, so indeed, while it's a big, still a bit futuristic target for aviation, there are many, many sectors of industry that are already using digital twins. I mentioned previously cars. For example, Tesla is actually creating for each physical car that they build a digital twin. And the digital twin and the physical car, they constantly communicate with each other. And data of the digital twin sent to a big database at Tesla. And they have they collect the data from all cars, and what they send back to each physical car are some like performance tuning or maintenance fixes. They try to suggest all these things. They can also go up to suggesting some changes to your car setup based on where you're driving, based on your driving style. So in case of Tesla, they're using it quite extensively. Another example that I like is in Formula One. Mercedes have a digital twin of their F1 car. So what they do is, before the actual race, they run thousands of virtual races, and they try to put as many different scenarios as they can, so that they create a very large database of information that they can use during the actual race, and they basically are prepared to any unexpected event. Yeah, as I said, for cars is of course very impressive what they're doing, but tuning this digital twins is relatively cheaper because producing a car is not so expensive, so you can easily test whether your simulation tools are accurate, and you can actually update them with the real data. What starts becoming quite a lot more challenging is this digital twin cities. So for example, the city of Singapore in Shanghai, they, with this 3D cameras with drones and satellite pictures, they created virtual versions of their cities. So Singapore recently completed the whole Singapore nation. It's a small nation, but they completed a virtual twin of the whole thing. And with this virtual twin, what they will do is supporting any urban development, or simply, I was reading that he, based on the direction of your building, they will try to understand which side is best to put your solar panels on, so that you can, you know, get more sunlight and charge your solar panels. And it's pretty interesting, but of course, it's a lot of work. We're talking about a huge amount of data. Yeah, big data science here, it's something that actually matured relatively recently, and it's something that is supporting this kind of projects. And I want to, just to conclude, another digital twin example with the digital human twin. There's this American company that they created like a body scan, who can basically make digital replica of your body, also being able to get internal organs. And what they would like to do is to get this digital replica of human beings and feeding them with data and using simulation tools, AI-based simulation tools, to use this digital human twins to, for example, do any kind of things like disease prevention, or you can, I imagine, do anything you want. Try and check with your little avatar if you eat too much for the next week and you don't go do any exercise, how much weight you're gonna get, or stuff like this.
And I guess I actually see a physical representation of what will happen in that specific case then.
Yeah.
It sounds very impressive, and I think would be a huge use, not only in the health industry and the physical exercises industry, but probably numerous uses.
Indeed.
And you said it gets your internal organs as well. Is this, do you know how much that it can already predict in that? Does it know, like, okay, if you eat a lot of natto or something, it will help your gut microbiome to this level? Or is that more of a something in 2050 that we'll be seeing?
Yeah, I think this digital human twins is, it might be even later. For the moment, I think this company is just developing a scan so they can get a list shapes of what your organs look like and these kind of things. But the predictive capabilities are something that it's much more long-term.
Interesting. In regard to the virtual twin or the digital twin of cities, such as Singapore that you mentioned, is this different from something like Google Maps, for example, in the information that you'd gain? Or does the digital twin include a lot more physical simulations and actually give you a lot more data? Or is there something that I'm completely missing here that is even more useful about them?
No, it's not too far from what a Google, how do you call it, Street View would be. Yeah. So you have indeed information about where buildings are located and so on. However, what they do is giving you some information about, for example, they will collect data for each whatever building about their energy efficiency, for example, electric consumption of whatever system we're looking at, whether it's a traffic light or commercial center. In this sense, it's like an augmented version of a Google Map or Google Street. It's way richer of information and data that you can actually use to make, politicians would use it during whatever new urban restructuring they're doing or proposing. There's also studies about how to improve the traffic flow of cars. So indeed, there are some overlaps with Google, but normally it would be a richer version of Google Maps.
A lot more extensive and data rich than just a physical representation of that area. We have, I guess, the historic data of like you mentioned, energy consumption and traffic and other things that you could probably look at to, I guess, implement changes or consider how to improve the city as a whole then, essentially.
Indeed, yeah.
That's interesting. And I suppose there's again, numerous uses for something like that, and which sounds like it's probably coming along pretty quickly. We might not even have to wait another 30 years. So.
Indeed. Yeah. Some people were talking about using this for example, metaverse. Mm-hmm. So this could be, one use that it's not directly related to. Political implementation, city development, but also for entertainment.
Yeah.
So indeed, it's not so far in the future, I think.
I think there's also quite a few games that already sort of have physical representations of cities and whatnot. Maybe, in the Batman games, you have Gotham City, but maybe that's not somewhere you can actually go. But maybe, in Spider-Man, you've got New York and which is more or less, I think, correct physical representation, despite a few, the Avengers Tower or whatever in there. So, that's a lot of interesting information. It sounds like there's a lot of potential projects that you could be working on. I don't know how much freedom you have in deciding what you want to work on, but could you discuss as to either how you specifically develop, put together, or join a research project or paper, it could be, in your field, and what are the important points that you consider when getting involved with a new project?
Yeah, this is an interesting and tough question. So at JAXA, of course, we have some objectives that are decided at higher levels. Within those objectives, we, of course, can propose many topics that we are interested in. So there's a first phase where it's important to understand if what you're doing, what you would like to do, goes within the main objectives of JAXA, of the project you're part of, that is not straightforward, because often what you think or what you would like to think that is extremely important might not be so significant for other people. But generally, the attitude here listed in my department and team is people are very supportive and definitely open to receiving new ideas. So after this first step of understanding whether it's interesting also within the project I'm part of, what I try to understand is what the current status of the art is. And normally, this is a bibliographic part. You just have to start reading articles and papers that have been published previously and trying to understand what's limiting the further progress in that whatever topic that you selected. Normally, you can identify a few either points in configurations, so that we are starting some in aircraft, in aviation. Some of the operational phases are quite tricky, so you can either identify what in terms of physics we cannot understand, or what in terms of methodology what we are still not able to do. So my second part is trying to understand what the problem is, why we have this problem. After that, I try to come up with a research question, meaning this problem that I have, I would like, for example, to solve it in a certain way by using a certain methodology. And my research question would be, is this feasible? Can I actually achieve these objectives and solve these problems, these current limitations, by applying this idea that I have, by developing these tools that I have? Once my research question and objectives are stated, I start trying to come up with a plan, a more detailed plan of what I would like to develop, why I think that developing this tool, this methodology, or studying this certain configuration can be helpful to solve that problem. Yeah, generally, once I do this, I have a few iterations also with colleagues, trying to get the feedback and idea of if what I'm doing makes sense. And once everything looks good, it's time either to start working on it and see if it works.
With the, I guess, step three was the research question, determining if your idea is feasible or not. Is this synonymous with a research hypothesis, or is a research question and a hypothesis different in some way?
So this might be my interpretation, but when I say research question is indeed a question I don't know the answer to. I'm trying my best to understand whether my idea could work, but I still call it question, open question, because until I try, I will not know the answer. So yeah, be difficult for, I don't know if you might call this also research hypothesis, but I tend to see it as something that is educated question. I think it might work. My idea might work, but will remain open until I try and see if it's actually working.
So you want to try and avoid making too many assumptions that way, I guess.
Yeah, maybe yes.
Let's just go over this again. So you go through the current state of the art by reading current articles and papers on a specific subject, assuming that you've already discovered what the subject is in line with the organizational goals, that is, I guess. And then you move into, identifying the problem and figuring out what is preventing further iterations or further progress, I guess. So what is the problem? You decide your research question, then you make a plan of action, do some iterations with the colleagues, and then you actually get to work. How long does this process have from identifying the state of the art all the way to actually getting started to work? How long does this, on average, let's say, will this take?
If we're talking about a paper, normally from gathering information to actually start doing work, it can be relatively quick, maybe intensively working on it, maybe take a month, or generally a good week to take your time off of other stuff and start reading literature is, I think it's important. Of course, we always reading papers, so it's not like I have, you know, 100 papers to read, but people publish very often. So every year you will get between 5 and 10 new papers that at some point you want to read. So it takes some time, and the fixing the ideas, iterations with colleagues also can take, yeah, some kind of maybe couple of weeks or so. If it's something more, a bit more, and this is the preparation part, of course, the actual work and then the preparation of the publication, for example, and going through the reviewing process of your publication in fluid dynamics can take up to a year. Normally, having one publication per year in fluid dynamics as a first author is a pretty good average. Of course, then you will have collaborations, and at a certain point of your career, you will have students. So maybe it will go a bit faster, but the time that it takes from your actual work to seeing your article published might be around 1 year. So it's not short. But if you, for example, you want to come up with research project, then things become a bit more complicated, because not only you have to go through the similar steps, but there will be at some point the need for preparing a research proposal that you will have to submit to a funding organization. That might be the government, might be your department head or whoever. Preparing the research proposal is pretty tough, because it's normally something that will be reviewed by, of course, people in science, but they might not be experts in whatever you are proposing. So differently from a paper, that will be scientific article will be reviewed by an expert in that field, a research proposal must be written in a way that it's simple and clear, but at the same time it has to be technical, because you of course are dealing with a technical problem, and you cannot avoid technical terms, but you cannot use technical terms that are too difficult to understand. So there's a real art about writing research proposals that in terms of time, it can take a long time. 2 years ago, I applied for this government grant, the Kakenki JSPS, that I was awarded, but the preparation of the research proposal only, it took maybe a couple of months, and iterations with colleagues and iterations with people that were experts in preparing research proposals. That is a tough one. And going up to very, very big projects that I see my boss, that is one of the main responsible for the digital transformation project, aircraft life cycle digital transformation project. that he has been doing that just to prepare it. It's been maybe a couple of years. There's so much work going into it that he's constantly attending conferences, reading papers, asking other researchers like me to attend conferences he cannot attend and report to him and gather information. And depending on the size, the preparation time also increases significantly.
I guess in regard to the research proposals, as you mentioned, I mean, congratulations on getting the grant that you did get. But when you're actually writing these and spending months just preparing the research proposal to hopefully achieve funding, there, I think, is usually a high probability, if it's just based on number of proposals to number of funding, that you will not get the funding. Is this true?
Very true.
So how do you sort of keep your mental state prepared and keep writing, even though you know that there's a high chance that you might not get the funding that you ask for?
Yeah, that is it's a tough one. Yeah. many researchers complain that at some point of your career, you will stop doing research and simply just write research proposals, because indeed is somewhat statistical. You need to apply and apply and apply, and some of them will be successful, some of them will not. It's very frustrating when you know that. Of course, you can target different kind of funding. There are some funding that you already know that you might have higher percentage of success. Others that the chances are lower, but normally the lower the chances, the larger the amount of money that you would get is.
It's like a lottery.
Indeed.
So going back to understanding the state of the art for a moment here, I think in most scientific fields anyway, the number of papers that come out related to a field in any period of time is more than any one person could humanly read. And maybe this is another place where artificial intelligence can be utilized, but how do you decide what papers to read if you have so many? Do you determine based on, let's say, where a paper was published or the author, or is it more focused on the very specific subject within your field of work, or maybe all of these? What is the process for deciding whether or not the paper is even worth reading, worth the time? Because most papers do take a lot of time to read, I think. So,
indeed. No, you're totally right. I think, like in everything, now there is an explosion, right, of information, and keeping track is super tough. In the past, whatever topic you had, you had maybe 5 to 10 papers that like holy papers, you have to read them. They were, at the forefront, and not many people in the world could do whatever they did in that paper. And that is the reference. Now it's so difficult to keep track of what everybody is publishing that very true. Sometimes you might miss some important ones. However, for sure, first thing is selecting the journal. So in each field, you have a certain number of journals that have, we call it impact factor. And the higher the impact factor, the higher visibility is. Doesn't mean necessarily that quality and impact factor are proportional. But in the years, we understood which of these journals are reliable and which are a bit less reliable. It's important also to understand that many of these journals have a strict peer review process, where normally 2, 3, or 4 referees are selected, and they will go in detail through your work. So you have a certain assurance that this paper will be of good quality and that probably you should read it. But nowadays there are many good researchers. Of course, you also know the groups that are working on a specific topic, and whatever they publish, you shouldn't miss. But many researchers nowadays, also the big ones, the important ones, they try to publish on open journals. And these open journals, normally there is not a reviewing process. So if you start taking into account of all the papers that everybody is publishing, is a very, very tough job to do. So generally, I try to look at the big journals from the most relevant researchers. What I like to do is, prior to their publications, people normally attend conferences and present their work. Often I see presentations at conferences, and later the presenting author converts his conference work to a journal paper. So I already know that that could be interesting and of good quality and worth reading. But indeed it is, as in many other aspects of, in many other different fields, it's getting a bit out of control. It's super tough to keep track.
Hopefully there is some way to gather all of the essential knowledge in a more bite-sized way. I have heard of a company, I can't remember the name offhand, but I think they were doing this specifically for papers on biology and biochemistry, where they were using an AI that sort of scours through thousands and thousands of papers every month and sort of compares common language and everything that comes up, and then sort of summarizes the entirety of the literature for that period of time in a single document. I haven't used this, and as I said, I can't even remember the name offhand, so maybe that's not very helpful, but I think that's maybe a solution to look forward to in the future, really relying on the AI to help determine what is important. And I suppose whether we're using AI or we are trying to read the papers ourselves, ultimately, there's still a risk of overlooking maybe some very interesting paper that was, for whatever reason, published in a very obscure journal, like John's Engineering Robotics Journal, or I don't know. Yeah, I guess
it could be a solution, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's a something that you'll always have to keep in the back of your mind while you're deciding the papers to so many factors, so many variables that you really have to look at there.
And you know, the nightmare is always you start doing your work.
Oh,
and
yes.
Halfway through or at the end, you see that it was done previously. That is, I've seen at one conference, this relatively young researcher, maybe was early stages PhD, and he's presenting his work. And this big professor that was chairing the session, halfway through his presentation, stops him and says, "Have you read this paper by blah, blah, blah?" I said, "No, I'm not sure." "Well, what you've done, it's exactly what they did 10 years ago."
Oh.
And this guy was like, "Okay, poor guy." That is the nightmare.
Has this ever happened to you? No.
Well, not yet.
Okay, that's good. Hopefully, it doesn't. Yeah, this would be. I mean, it's unfortunate that it happened to that particular person, but I think for most people, it's understandable that this sort of thing could potentially happen, because there's such a huge quantity of existing papers, and there's only a limited amount that you might be able to review before, you know, giving a presentation or anything. So, but yeah, it's definitely something I think it would be not very good for you or your self-confidence to happen on stage like that, maybe.
Indeed.
Doing a little bit of a change in topics here, I want to get into a couple things regarding your career history and your life history, such as you can go start back as far back as you'd like, and regarding how you or where you were born and essentially what you studied, where you went to school, how you ended up at JAXA, and any interesting points that you might want to mention in between there.
Yeah, so I'm Italian. I was born in Rome. And pretty much, yeah, I grew up there. I did all my studies there. At the end of my master course, you know, in Europe, there is this project called Erasmus Project, that some sort of an exchange program between universities, and you can join temporarily another university that belongs to this program, and either attend their classes or with a professor, you can do a small project or final project of your master. And it's funded by the EU, so you get relatively low amount of money to go abroad, live there, and do your studies. And I did this at the University of Cranfield in England. Cranfield is a small city, maybe 100 kilometers north of London, maybe a bit more. And there I was actually working on space debris. My specialization during the master was space propulsion. So within the framework of space debris, I was trying to come up with different configurations of spacecraft and focusing on the spacecraft propulsion system, trying to optimize the performance and weight so that they could collect and remove space debris from the low Earth orbit. And during this Erasmus project, I started working with programming languages and writing some small codes, and I was getting more and more interested in programming. And when I went back to Rome to complete my degree, I started thinking what I could have done, and I decided to move to fluid dynamics because I thought it was quite interesting. And after my experience at Cranfield, I went back briefly to Cranfield to complete a master over there as well. But it was more of a bit of a continuation of the space debris project. But after Cranfield, I went to Southampton in the south of England. And there I did my PhD in numerical fluid dynamics. Main topics was high-speed flows, but from a numerical point of view. Once I completed my PhD, I moved to Paris in France, where I was working with a French space agency that's called CNES, in affiliation with a university in Paris called ENSAM, Arts et Métiers. And there the knowledge I gathered about programming and fluid dynamics and numerical fluid dynamics during my PhD, I applied it to a more realistic application. So during my PhD, I was studying very basic configurations that were very fundamental. So I was more interested in physics rather than the application. But during my postdoc in France, I was looking at the rocket engine nozzle of the next launcher of the French space agency, Ariane 6. And there was a problem during takeoff with this engine, or better, with the nozzle. And I was developing some methodologies to study these instabilities at takeoff that make the nozzle vibrate so much that at some point it can actually explode. And this methodology that I was developing as a side project, little side project, I was using it to study high-speed flows on wings. During this postdoc, I went to a conference in Nagoya where I met my current boss. He was presenting things about this, same things about this side project of mine. So high-speed flows on wings. So we started chatting. After Nagoya, he invited me to give a small seminar in Tokyo. So I was actually traveling for holiday after the conference, a little bit in Japan. And I took the opportunity to visit JAXA, give the seminar. And we started talking about the possibility for me to work here. And indeed, after a while, I applied for aerospace project research associate position that I got. I worked with JAXA for 3 years, from 2018 until last year in April. Since April, after a series of interviews, partially done in Japanese also, I got this permanent research staff position. And since last year, yes, I'm happily continuing my work at JAXA. It's been recently 1 year because I started 1st of April last year.
Oh, congratulations on the permanent position there. There's a couple questions that I actually wanted to ask. I suppose I'll work backwards here, because you did mention that the interview was done partially in Japanese. So how is your Japanese currently? What would you say your level of Japanese is?
So recently, I signed up for N3, the GLPT, that I'm going to do this summer.
And this is the Japanese language proficiency test.
Yes.
There's level 1 through 5 or 4?
Yes. So 1 to 5, where 5 is the lowest.
Mm-hmm. The 3 is somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle. So, with partially done in Japanese, my interviews, I did as much as I could in Japanese. Whenever things were getting too difficult for me to understand, I would at least ask to repeat the question in English, but try to answer as much as I could in Japanese. A lot of preparation went into it, and I worked very hard on my potential questions and answers during an interview to make them in Japanese, and practiced a lot with my Japanese teacher, with my friends, and it was not easy.
You've been in Japan for roughly 5 years now, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, 4 years next month.
4 years next month. Have you had a Japanese teacher or been diligently learning Japanese for the entire time, or is that more of a recent thing that you've been trying to do?
So one-to-one classes I started 2.5 years ago. For the first year and a half, I was attending some weekly group classes, but of course, when you have one-to-one lessons, you can significantly improve. So the first year and a half, my progress was not so great. When I started the one-to-one, I could already see significant improvement after a while. And of course, it depends on how much effort you put, not only during the classes, but also outside when you try to talk to people and attend, language exchange meetings and try to get your friends, Japanese friends, to talk to you a little bit in Japanese. And you try to tell what your day looked like, your weekend was. So especially now with my new position, there is a lot of course, work that I have to do in Japanese, from admin work to reporting to the big bosses, and all these things have to be done in Japanese. Yeah, also presenting a few slides for 3 minutes, it becomes a tough job. Yeah, I guess with time it will be easier, I hope.
Yeah, and I think when you are forced into this situation where you don't really have the choice, it does probably help you get a grasp of the language a lot faster, I think. I don't know, one thing that I personally find useful for language acquisition, and this is, of course, just my own take on this, is watching, let's say, a TV series, for example, especially something that's continuing for many episodes rather than just a movie. So, and the reason for this is so you can sort of get a sense of the characters and situations and know how a certain person would talk to whomever in a certain situation, rather than, you know, a movie where you only have 2 hours or whatever. So what am I trying to say here? So in the TV show, you'd want to set both the subtitles and the audio to your target language. Mm-hmm. And then I think they sort of augment each other or are auxiliary information when you're listening and you don't quite catch what someone says, you can try and read it. And especially with a language like Japanese, where the characters can be so complex, you might be reading the subtitles and not be able to read them. But if they're, hopefully the subtitles and the actual spoken dialogue are the same. But yeah, in this case, you know, you can't read the characters, but you can hear someone pronouncing them as you're reading them. I think this can be quite a good use of television for educational purposes. Okay, so while we are on the subject of, there's a few things that I wanted to ask about your career history as well, but I'll get right back to that. I want to, just while we're on the subject of Japan and Japanese, I want to ask how you actually enjoy Japan as opposed to some of the other countries that you mentioned that you've been to along, I guess, your academic journey so far.
Yeah, so without talking ill about other countries, the food culture in Japan is big part of why I like it. I don't want to sound stereotypical, but as an Italian person, food is very important. And weather, of course, it can be extreme in Japan. You kind of have everything. You have cold time, you have hot times, you have relatively mild temperatures during the year at some points, you have dry seasons, you have rainy seasons, and it's somewhat enjoyable, I think, rather than in other countries where weather is a bit more constantly bad. And I don't want to point at any country, but there are some countries that tend to be very cloudy and rainy. So I like this change during the seasons. I like it a lot. Weather and food are great. Yeah, despite the troubles one might have with the language, the kindness of Japanese people is always surprising me, because often they go to unexpected lengths to help you do things when you are not able to. And in general, there's certain politeness that is the basics of what human interactions. So it's what human interactions here is based on is politeness. And I think it's always a good point to start from. And yeah, living in Japan is also good because I love the job, what I'm doing. And that is a big part of my day, big part of my week. Putting all these things together, yeah, make my life in Japan pretty good. What is the biggest drawback is that it's very far from home, from Italy, from my family, and most of my friends. Yeah, I of course I cannot go back as often as I would when I was in France or England. So you need to be plan in advance in order to get tickets when they're not too expensive, and you need to coordinate with your colleagues, because you go back and you're not going to go back for a weekend, at least, you know, a week or two. And so you need to make sure you're not leaving extra workload to your colleagues. And with a bit of planning, usually pre-COVID, I could go back and see my family. Since COVID, it's been tough. I missed a couple of Christmases and summer, so it's I look forward to this travel restrictions to to loosen, and hopefully I can go back a bit more often.
Besides the necessity for careful planning and the COVID restrictions that might not be Japan exclusive, but what were some of the most difficult challenges that you've had to overcome during these roughly 4 years of living in Japan so far?
Mostly I would say administration related. Whatever registering, starting from the first things you have to do when you arrive in Japan, like registering to a city hall or opening a bank account. I see now that there's a lot of support in English, and for sure that was as well 4 years ago when I arrived. It's not so long ago, but it's sometimes a little tough to do these things on your own, because of for sure the communication. Some of the things that you could do online, like opening a bank account, it can be not so straightforward for foreigners. So most of my problems have been of this nature, related to language.
Administrative processes, I think this is probably a very common problem. Like some, maybe even banks or large organizations that you would expect to have dealt with various problems might not have the system in place for even the registration of people who don't have Japanese names even. There's often character limits or the types of characters that you're allowed to enter. Or we even have one colleague from Indonesia here at JAXA, a mutual friend of ours who doesn't have a last name. So, he's definitely had a lot of difficulties in that area as well, I think. So this is, something I think a lot of places could maybe look for areas to improve in, when you can only have a max number of you have 4 characters in your first name and then 4 in your last name, and maybe your first name or last name alone is like 11 characters. It's not gonna work out so well. So I definitely understand that. You said you really like the food over here. What do you like specifically? Is there, I think a lot of people like sushi, but that might be the most common answer. That's fine if you like sushi, no?
No, actually, you mentioned it. Natto.
I'm a huge natto
fan. I love it. Yes, my current favorite is mochi with natto. I'm in love with this combination. And it's my breakfast actually every day. I have that. And recently I've also tried to make natto with a yogurt maker. After boiling the beans, you put them in this yogurt maker where you can control the temperature. You start the fermentation process. There are different ways, but I simply put some natto that was already done and mixed it. And if you keep it for some time at a constant temperature, then magically you have natto. Yeah, Natto is my favorite, and it's very funny because every time a Japanese person asks me what's your favorite food, I say natto. It's always, you know, a bit of a shock. And I remember with some kids they were on a school trip, I think, and I was traveling somewhere in the north of Japan, and these kids came to me with the notebook and asked me in English, what is your favorite Japanese food? And I said natto, and they went crazy. They started laughing. I was like, it was fun.
Yeah, I guess just for anybody listening who might not know, natto is a, I'm not even sure exactly how to describe it. I guess a bean paste mixture, fermented beans, and it has a very distinct smell, texture, and taste that I would say even within Japan, where it is a common food, there's, you'll probably have about a 50-50 as to whether people will avoid natto at all costs or be okay with natto. So it's people are really divided on whether or not natto is good in the sense of for taste and texture, if it's good for meat. But the health benefits are mostly undeniable. I think I brought it up in the context of the microbiome much earlier, and fermented foods, and especially natto, as it's really a high level health food. I think it's marketed that way anyway, is quite good. So it sounds like a very healthy breakfast and a good favorite food to have. Yeah, that's great. I was surprised too that you natto is your favorite food. So going back, jumping back to your career history, there's two questions that I had that I want to ask here. One thing is, you mentioned that you were studying and researching numerical fluid dynamics, and I think fluid dynamics has come up a few times in this conversation, but I'm not sure if everybody really understands what fluid dynamics are and what numerical fluid dynamics are and how these are used. Could you just explain roughly about numerical fluid dynamics?
Sure. So fluid dynamics, fluid mechanics, we usually use it to indicate what a fluid does usually around a certain solid body. So in my specific case, what I look at, the fluid would be the air, a solid body would be the aircraft. It's numerical because, so if we imagine when we do an experiment, so physical experiments, I mentioned earlier, for example, in the wind tunnel, we have a scaled down model of an aircraft, and we throw air at different speeds to the aircraft, and we see what goes on. However, what we can do, the other alternative to a physical experiment is a virtual experiment, numerical experiment. And what we have is a set of equations that we call Navier-Stokes equations. And these equations, they describe how the air moves around the aircraft, how the density changes, how the temperature changes. Problem with these equations is that we don't have an exact solution, so we cannot solve them directly, but we have to use calculus. Simply put, we take our aircraft and the air surrounding it, and we divide the space in very, very tiny bits. For each of these tiny bits, we solve locally the Navier-Stokes equations, these equations that regulate motion and temperature and density. And then we put everything together. And by putting everything together numerically, we can see what goes on around an aircraft. When I was mentioning how simulations can be very expensive, is because if we want to be accurate in the way we solve these equations and we have an accurate representation of reality, we have to divide the aircraft and the air surrounding it in very, very, very tiny bits. And the tinier, the more accurate your representation will be. And sometimes going to very, very tiny bits of airplane and air, it means that you have to do billions and billions of calculations. These billions and billions of calculations, you cannot do them on normal computers like our laptops, but you have to use supercomputers that have, first of all, many, many processors, and they have high computing power, so they can perform many operations, and that you have many processors that can perform many operations, and if you use them in parallel, you can solve these types of problems. But using many processors and using in general supercomputer, it's very expensive in terms of electricity, in terms of computing power, storage, many things. And this is the limit of our numerical simulations, that if you want a very accurate representation of reality, they become very expensive.
One other question I had was, you mentioned that you worked for a French space organization. I think you said CNES. So is this related to ESA at all, or is this a completely independent space organization?
So yeah, this is the French one within. So they have collaborations with ESA. So the most active ones in Europe are definitely ESA, the German one, DLR, CNES, the French one, ASI, the Italian one as well. They all collaborate under the big umbrella of ESA, probably for some European projects, like some rocket launchers and some, space missions. But effectively, they, CNES, DLR, the German, and ASI, the Italian one, they are pretty separate and independent.
So you went from one space organization to a different space organization in your career?
Yeah.
Interesting. I would like to know on a personal level now, when you are not in the lab or you're not working on research or reading thousands and thousands of papers to get updated on the state of the art, do you have any notable hobbies or things that you really like to do in your spare time?
Yes, I'm a big fan of rock music and blues. I've been playing guitar since I was 15, 16. I started a bit late with a Colombian guitar teacher. This guy was teaching me mostly classical guitar. We started moving towards flamenco. But then after I started the university, met some of my friends that were really into rock and blues. I started feeling the desire to have an electric guitar, and I abandoned classical and flamenco to something a bit more distorted and rock. When I was in England, four out of five members of the band I was in, they were in the same office. So we were office mates and bandmates. Often after the working day, we would, just go to the rehearsal room and play a little bit. And sometimes we had a few concerts in some of the bars and in a pizza restaurant also. A couple of times, always locally in the city where we were studying in Southampton. We came up with a few original songs. We recorded them on my laptop, nothing professional, but it was a lot of fun. And after I left England in France, I couldn't really find anyone to play with. So when I came here, I said, I really want to look for someone and do some jam sessions. Yeah, about 1.5 years ago, I met one guy who plays the drums. And since we've been meeting maybe a couple of times per month in some of the studio either here in Kichijoji where I live or in Nakano. Yeah, we just jam and we might have a couple of gigs, one in beginning of May maybe, but it's going to be an extremely small bar, very, very small. And maybe a little festival that one of the friends of this drummer, friend of mine, he organizes like a Nakano, how's it called? Nakano Music Festival, something like that. We might also play there. So my main hobby is definitely guitar. I buy way too many guitars. I have too many. I also bought recently a shamisen.
I see it behind you right now. That's yes. Cool. Shamisen and natto. You're really getting into the Japanese
shamisen
culture.
Shamisen and natto, yeah.
And a bunch of guitars. That's nice.
Yes. However, my shamisen has never been played by anyone. I still learn. I'm still waiting to start learning. And recently the skin broke. I think it was a bit too dry, so I need to replace that before starting to learn.
So what is the name of the band that you're in now?
I'd be shy about saying this, but it's it's called Roma Saga Blues Explosion.
Roma Saga Blues Explosion.
Blues Explosion, yeah. So it's Roma Saga because I'm from Rome. This guy is from Saga. And Blues Explosion because it's part of a band that we both like, that it's called John Spencer Blues Explosion. So we stole that second part and added Roma Saga at the beginning.
So I guess if anybody's in anybody listening in Japan wants to go check you out, they could look up your live schedule and you visit one of your concerts in the coming days. Awesome. Guitars. Yeah, we've had the episode that will probably be released right before this one, as well as the episode released in March, both guests talked about doing musical instruments as well. So if you need any more people for your band, you have some people to contact at JAXA.
Definitely. We can do JAXA band.
Yeah. Why did you end up wanting to apply to JAXA in the first place? I'm sure after graduating and having already worked at a space organization, there's probably plenty of organizations that work in space development or space exploration. And I'm sure there's a lot of places that also would be interested in your knowledge in fluid dynamics. But why did you specifically decide to go to JAXA as opposed to somewhere else?
Yeah, so the biggest attraction was the fact that the department where I was applying for, the biggest topic was the topic that I was already researching when I was in France. So it was not my main topic when I was in France. It was a bit of a side project, but I had great interest in this topic. Yeah, again, when reading papers and looking at what other people are doing, many of the publications and experiments, especially about this specific application, were done here in Chofu, with the wind tunnels that we have here in Chofu. So it was pretty natural choice to go here because I was super interested in this topic, and I really wanted to follow through. And here I also had the possibility to help with the experiments. I'm not an experimentalist, but I was supporting the experiments, not only with my simulations, but physically going to do the experiments, and had little tasks. All these opportunities that were promised actually were a big incentive for me to apply and to come here. Indeed, it was a good choice because I could definitely participate to experiments. Often, as a numerical scientist, we tend to spend way too much time in front of the computer programming, and the risk that you detach from reality is very big. So going to the wind tunnels, helping these guys, and learning a lot from them, because they are extremely knowledgeable and very cool people, super kind. There was a lot of knowledge that I got from simple tasks that were given to me. And in general, this collaboration with experimentalists is very unique. Not many institutions can have it. This was a big part. And the other one was, so when you do simulations, you normally need, as I mentioned, a supercomputer, and access to a supercomputer is not trivial. It's a big problem. Unless you have local cluster, local supercomputer, what you have to do is apply for grants and get computational time. JAXA has a local supercomputer. A couple of years ago, we upgraded to what now is called JSS3. Yeah, very powerful computer on the same architecture of Fugaku that I mentioned is the most powerful computer in the world. It's a Japanese one. Having a supercomputer that you can use every day and having the possibility to do experiments and interact with experimentalists on the topic that you love, it's something, you know, pretty unique. Yeah, so far I'm super happy of my decision to come here, to keep working here. And yeah, I hope it's gonna stay like this for some time.
I'm glad that everything seems to be working out. You're able to access a lot of the resources that make your work, I guess, go a lot more smoothly and get a lot of extra experiences. And on the topic of resources, I do like to ask the guests if they have any specific tools or resources that they can recommend for people who, let's say, are interested in the type of work that you're doing, be that aircraft creation or just simulations in general. If you have any tools or resources that you can recommend to people who don't have access to a supercomputer necessarily.
Yes. So this is also an interesting question. I was trying to think of something that, yeah, would be accessible to anybody. So recently I have, as I mentioned earlier, started working with machine learning, AI. One of the things that I don't like so much about machine learning and AI is that the algorithms that we use create some models, but these models are very difficult to, the interpretation of these models is very difficult. And the point that we call it black boxes. They are some sort of black boxes that we cannot really look into. We don't really know what's going on. So I've been working recently with a tool that it's called SINDI, that stands for Sparse Identification of Nonlinear Dynamics. And it's a tool that has been developed by Professor Steve Branton and his colleagues and his group at University of Washington. The first technical great thing about this tool is that if you feed SINDI with a training data set, what SINDI will do is identify a system of equations. And this system of equations, you can use it to predict some new cases. So basically, it's what machine learning AI do, but instead of having a black box, with SINDI, we have a system of equations that we can look at, and each equation, each term of each equation, we can give it a physical interpretation, and it helps us to understand better what is going on. So from a technical point of view, it's a step towards interpreting the AI-based or machine learning-based model that with the classical techniques we cannot really do. And the other extremely useful thing that Professor Branton and his colleagues did and keep doing was that they created Python libraries that you can use, that you can freely download from the GitHub. And basically you can use Cindy on your laptop for free. And they provide a lot of documentation to support the user for technicalities on how to program and use Cindy. And Professor Branton, he has also a YouTube channel that is full of very, not only scientifically interesting, but also entertaining videos. And a subset of them is about this tool. So it's very well explained. You can use it. It's accessible for everyone. And actually, I got the pleasure to invite Professor Branton to this year's ANS conference. It's a conference, domestic conference that JAXA co-organizes. And every year, we invite a couple of international speakers. This year, I got in touch with Professor Branton, and I asked him if he wanted to present, to give a plenary talk. And he kindly agreed. So in end of June, he will be presenting machine learning methods applied to fluid dynamics. He will give a lesson about this. And I'm very excited because, I'm sure it's going to be interesting and entertaining. He's very, very interesting, young and promising guy. It's great.
You said Cindy, S-I-N-D-Y, Cindy?
Yes.
Okay. I'll try to remember to put a link in the show notes to Professor Brunton's YouTube channel in regard to the...
That would be great.
Using this. And this is a tool that anyone with, I guess, a good grasp of Python programming, which as far as I have seen, seems to be the most popular language in academia anyway. anyone who can use Python should be able to use this tool.
Yeah, definitely.
What kind of predictions can be made using it? What can you provide an example of something maybe that you have actually got out of using this tool?
Yes. So applications span from really any kind. They applied it to chaotic mathematical systems, to financial systems, to fluid dynamic applications. In my case, what I've done with one professor in France, who's actually a close collaborator of Professor Branton, and his name is Professor Loiseau at the University of Paris, where I was before, and some university. We used Cindy. What we did was doing a bunch of simulations on a wing. The speed regime was high speed flow. So at a certain speed and certain angle of attack of your wing, what happens is that there will be some shock wave forming on the wing. And for certain angles of attack, this shock wave will start oscillating. And these oscillations are detrimental for performances, and they're very dangerous for the structure because they can cause damage to the structure. Doing simulations about this is normally quite expensive. If you want to predict when these oscillations start, at which angle of attack these oscillations start, can be pretty expensive because you have to do many simulations for many angles of attack, many inclinations of your wing. So what we did was doing only a few simulations at certain angles of attack. And we used these simulations as a training data set that we gave to Cindy. And Cindy identified a system of equations that could help us predict when these oscillations would start. And when they were starting, the system of equations could also describe, for example, some aerodynamic forces like the lift or the drag, how they behave, how they change in time. The great thing about Cindy is that for one simulation with a classical solver, it would take around, in this specific case was relatively cheap simulations, but it would take order of days, 1 week or so. With Cindy, we could reproduce the dynamics at a certain angle of attack within seconds. So the power of the machine learning and Cindy combined is pretty impressive, and you can significantly reduce the computational costs and time. And Cindy can be run on a normal laptop, so really anybody can use it.
Yeah, you don't need a your own supercomputer.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's great. So I guess anybody with some knowledge in Python anyway can go download Cindy and take a look, try it out, see what you can do with it, and maybe look at Professor Brunton's YouTube channel before going crazy. Yes. With it. So let's see, you mentioned that it can also be used for financial data, and I will just use that as a segue to get into one of the final questions that I like to ask the guest. And this is, if you suddenly had a near unlimited budget, JAXA or whomever said, okay, you have $1 trillion to put towards anything that you want, any ridiculous amount of money to put towards anything in your research field, what would you use that on?
So yeah, this is also a very good question. I think, I mentioned earlier that I applied for this JSPS Kakenki funding from the government. Yeah, I got an amount of money that allowed me to do a numerical preliminary study on some wings that whose configuration I took it from. I was inspired by the humpback whale. Mm-hmm. So this big whales, they have pectoral fins on the front part. They have a wavy fin. It seems that this specific configuration of their fins allows them to be very agile and do maneuvers in water that normally for such a big animal wouldn't be possible. Some other researchers use this, we call it biomimicking, biomimetic wings for low speeds. But based on some idea that I had some time ago, I thought that if we put this wavy configuration on a certain part of the wing, we might be able to suppress one of these instabilities that occur at high speeds, this oscillating shockwave that I mentioned earlier. And now I have been doing some simulations that they look very promising. But of course, simulations need support from experiments. So with a larger budget, my first thing would be surely to manufacture these wings and start, I would test them in a wind tunnel. But I would start with some simple wings. And then the idea, if really I had a lot of money, I would eventually test them on an actual plane, and it would be very funny looking wing, but it would be able to suppress very dangerous instability that actually is one of the main limitations of so-called flight envelope, some flight conditions that we cannot get to and we cannot explore and actually exploit all our aircraft potential because of this phenomenon. So if we could find a way to suppress this instability, maybe with this kind of wings, it would be great breakthrough in aviation.
Probably another mutual acquaintance of ours, colleague that we both work with, also in the engineering area is also quite interested in bio-inspired engineering and mechanics mm-hmm. there. So I think that it seems to be sort of a theme among a lot of engineers. And you're probably you're the first engineer on this podcast so far. Maybe the other engineers are a bit shy or nothing. Nobody's put their hands up. It seems like I think a lot of people are interested in bio-inspired or bio-mimicking sort of mechanics. And that's definitely an area that becomes more and more interesting the more you hear and the more you look and probably find out a lot about some very strange animals that you didn't know existed until you go looking. Is there any specific reason why you particularly were interested in biomimicking, or is this sort of just something that came about when you were reading the literature?
Yeah, mostly, yeah, the second. It was by reading some papers at in different flow conditions. So, for example, already some applications in real life use this kind of wing configurations are those stabilizers, these fins below the surfing board. This configuration below the surfing board makes the board more stable. And one day I was looking at I wanted to start surfing lessons. I haven't yet, but I was looking at boards, and I saw that some of them have this wavy configuration, and looking a bit into that, then I saw that there was actually a large body of literature about this. And then I started thinking, could this work at higher speeds? Because I think if I put it in this specific part of the wing, maybe it could. That was the whole process for starting to think maybe I should try to run some simulations and see if it works. And they seem to be promising. Now it's early stages, but I definitely would like to continue on this and see if I get the chance to manufacture them and do some experiments. It would be very interesting.
Whether it's bio-inspired or surfing-inspired, it's inspiration that could be very useful for the next scientific endeavor. Just one final question that I'd like to ask here. I like to leave the audience with an interesting fact, theory, suggestion, piece of information, something to remain in their minds after listening to this podcast and ponder on for the rest of the day. Do you have anything that you'd like everybody out there, everybody listening, to think about?
Yeah, I don't want to sound catastrophic, but I have certain worry about how artificial intelligence and machine learning is used nowadays. I have seen the conferences I attend, the publications, the papers that I read, more and more we find AI applied to any kind of application. Directly, I have seen some people using AI on problems they didn't really understand, they didn't master. The trust they put in the machine learning program was somewhat blind. And they didn't realize that the answers that the machine learning was giving them were non-physical. They didn't make any sense, but simply because they had very, very good knowledge about the machine learning part, but very little knowledge about the physics that they were looking at. And this is okay. Nobody's expected to be an expert in both. However, there is a tendency in doing this, and is a little dangerous also if you think that most of the time, as I said previously, these softwares, these machine learning models work as black boxes. We cannot really understand what is going on. Often if you have a good understanding also of the physics and you see that your machine learning model gives you wrong answers, the first fix is we put more data in the training data set, or we change a little bit what is going on in the machine learning algorithm that we've wrote, and we do it until the answers start looking right. And these are very powerful tools. We made some incredible progress on many things, but I think we should never forget to focus on understanding not only the physics of the problem, but also what is going on in the machine learning algorithm, why it's working or why it's not working. And this is one reason why I like this Cindy tool that I mentioned earlier, because it gives you the tools to understand what the machine learning is doing. Yeah, there is you might know the Russian chess grandmaster Kasparov. He was beaten by Deep Blue, the IBM AI chess software, and he became an advocate for the use of machine learning and AI, because he also mentioned in some interviews, yes, it beat me, but I learned so much from that software. Playing with it, I learned many things. Recently, also the AlphaGo, this Chinese game Go, recently beat the Korean world champion of Go. And they all have this tendency to say, yes, there's a lot that we can learn from the machine learning. So I like to think that we should keep in mind that machine learning is a tool. And if we combine it with our knowledge and with our understanding, then we can create something good. We shouldn't just blindly trust AI and apply it to anything, because it could be somewhat catastrophic.
Don't take away the human component, and I guess continue questioning the answers that you receive are
definitely
two of the takeaways there, maybe. So that was, that's a very interesting point, something to think about. And AI is definitely something that has been taking off, AI and machine learning, for the past, I guess, several decades already, but it's continuing to go on and get closer to the realm of science fiction. And I think a lot of people have both hopes and concerns in regard to where that will be going. And there's a lot to think about how it will become, how you people put together the machine learning and what we can learn from it, among many other things. So, yeah, a lot to think about there. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and talking about all these interesting subjects. I learned a lot. I think a lot of people learn a lot and hopefully make the time to try out Cindy and see how that can be used. It's definitely a lot of interesting information there. Thank you for sharing everything. It was great speaking with you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for your interesting questions. It was great talking to you.